me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Tax time approaches, a couple of months away now. Perhaps you feel it looming. Well, today we're here to help you prepare for April 15th. We welcome your tax questions this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests today, two tax experts from the Champaign office of the tax accounting and consulting firm of RSM McGladrey. They are Marty Burdick and John Breen, and over the years they've been frequent guests on this program. Marty Burdick is a managing director at RSM McGladrey. John Breen is a manager in the firm's tax department. Here are the telephone numbers, listeners, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Nice to see you guys again.
Good afternoon. Good to be back.
Any recent changes in tax law that people will encounter as they prepare their returns for the year 2000?
There are a few new things. Many of the changes are things that have been scheduled to be implemented, just scheduled increases in things like a deduction for business equipment that is scheduled to increase each year, those kinds of things. There is a new change in Illinois that people might be interested in. It's called the education credit, and it's a credit that is a maximum credit of $500. It is a credit based upon tuition, fees, and books paid to public or private schools, and the credit is equal to 25% of those costs in excess of $250, and that's something that's new this year. Has not gotten a lot of publicity, so it's something that people might easily miss. And for people, especially people sending their children to schools that do have significant fees, many of the public schools, that wouldn't be an issue. But for some of the private schools where they pay significant tuition, that could result in a nice tax credit for them.
Okay. Well, speaking of education, if you are working and you've gone back to school to boost your skills, boost your marketability, that kind of thing, are those costs, tuition fees, books, and so on, deductible on your federal tax form?
Well, the general rule is that if education costs lead to qualification in a new profession, even though you might not intend to do that, but if those costs lead to qualification in a new profession, they wouldn't be deductible. For example, if I were to go to law school and get a law degree, the cost of that would not be a deductible item, even though I might easily be able to argue that it directly relates to what I do every day. The reason for that is it would qualify me for a new occupation, that is, as an attorney versus a CPA. So in general, that's the test to apply. Does it qualify you for a new occupation? If it's education that you're taking to simply maintain your skills required for the job, that would be. So in most cases that we look at where someone goes back to get a master's degree or to get a PhD, in most cases those would not qualify as deductible items because it would qualify them for a new position such as teaching at the higher education level, something like that.
Okay. What if you're in a job and you're going to be given new responsibilities, new duties, or would that be deductible?
It very possibly. Many times employers will encourage people. For example, we encourage our tax people to go to get a master's in tax. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we pay for that if someone wants to do that. If we encourage an employee to do that because it relates directly to what they're doing, but we don't pay for it, then that would be a deductible item. And it's a gray area because when is it encouraged? When is it required? If you're going to be a manager at a business and your employer says, "Gee, I'd sure like it if you had your MBA," does that become a deductible item? It's really based upon the particular facts and circumstances. There's not a clear-cut test.
Okay. Well, here we are in the middle of February, and folks are, I'm sure, thinking about their tax return if they haven't already.
I hope they are.
To work on it. At this point, is there anything we can do to decrease our tax liability? John?
Well, conceivably, if you qualify, an IRA would certainly be something that would be an option. There are some income limitations associated with whether or not you can deduct that. You also have to have earned income, which is another requirement in order to be able to do that. For self-employed people, they would have an option to contribute to a simplified employee pension plan, which works much like an IRA. It's just that they normally can deduct a larger amount because it's based on a percentage of their self-employment income. And those are deductions that you can actually make the contribution after the first of the year and still have it count for last year.
Okay. And what about thinking about next year? What kinds of things might we want to think about, strategies for decreasing tax liability?
Well, right now, it's a little bit iffy because we don't know exactly what set of tax rules we're going to be working under. The Bush administration has proposed a number of changes, including rate cuts, including relief for something called the marriage penalty tax that that we can talk about if we have time later. So it's a little bit difficult to suggest planning strategies. The normal strategies include acceleration of deductions, deferral of income, shifting of income to lower tax bracket family members, some of those kinds of things. The big issue right now is what set of rules are we going to be operating under?
Okay. We've got a listener lined up ready to talk with us this afternoon on the toll-free line in Terre Haute, Indiana. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I had a question on withdrawing money from your IRA after you're 70 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand it, in working out from the tables, I want to do it actuarially between myself and my wife. And I started in 1999, and I was told that I, from the tables, it would work out to be 21 and I think 0.2. And I've taken out, you know, I was getting, my payments from it were in excess of that anyway, so I didn't really have to withdraw anything then, but I reported. And coming into my third year, do I just simply subtract one number from that, like 1/21st the first year, 1/20th the second year, 1/19th the third year? Is that sufficient?
Well, that's one choice. It depends on what election you made at the time that you began taking withdrawals. And what you're referring to when you talk about 21, 20, 19, it's the life expectancy that the government has decided that you have. Isn't that nice of them to figure that out for us?
Right.
Based upon actuarial tables. So you're using, obviously, a joint life expectancy, since you mentioned you and your wife. And you have two choices when you begin making withdrawals. You can either calculate that using what is called with recalculation or without recalculation. If you choose to do it without recalculation, you simply subtract a year for each additional year that you've lived. So if you started at 21, you go to 20, then 19, then 18. If you elected to use a recalculation method, you would go back to the table each year and recalculate the new life expectancy. And what's interesting is that if it was 21 years the first time you did it, 1 year later, your life expectancy, joint life expectancy, is not 20, it's probably 20.2. Because just by living another year, your life expectancy didn't go down by an entire year. I would caution you to be very careful on this calculation, because the penalty for failure to withdraw the appropriate amount under this minimum distribution calculation is 50% of the amount of the distribution that you didn't take. So if you should have taken $5,000 and you only take $4,000, that $1,000 shortfall could result in a penalty of 50% or $500. So you do want to be accurate in that calculation. And many times the brokerage house or the bank that's handling your money will do that calculation for you.
Can you take that recalculation, you know, 5 or 10 years in, if you've been just reducing by 1 year at a time, when you're, say, down to the 15 or the 10-year mark, can you again go back and take it from the actuarial tables?
No, once you elect a method, you are stuck with that method. So if you elect to do the without recalculation method, it will just continue to decrease 1 year at a time until you get to a point where you're going to have to take everything out because you've run out of years, even if you're still alive. There have been some recent changes in the IRA distribution rules that are designed to provide some additional alternatives and to simplify that. I have not spent a lot of time looking at those changes yet because I believe they just go into effect in 2001.
And how do you establish which way you're taking it out? When I called and asked them, they wanted no papers, no paperwork at all on what way you were doing this.
That is a little odd. Normally, I see people having to fill out a form that they submit to the bank or to the trust company that's handling it. Normally, that's an election that is made in the first year of the distribution.
I did tell the bank, at each one where I have an IRA, I have informed them the nature of the way I'm taking it out. But nothing to the IRS itself?
No, there's nothing that goes to the IRS.
It's simply
the notification that you made to the bank or the investment company. The IRS does not get that notification.
Oh, okay. That's what I was wondering, how they know what I'm doing.
They trust you until they audit you.
Okay, I thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Why is that penalty so stiff?
Well, they want to make sure that people, that the advantage of IRAs and retirement plans is the tax-deferred savings. And the government wants to make sure that when you hit age 70 and a half, which is the age at which you have to start taking distributions, that you begin to actually take that money out, that you don't continue to just allow that deferral to go on indefinitely. It's a severe penalty, and you can request abatement of the penalty if you have reasonable cause. For example, if you directed the bank to make that distribution before the end of the year and they just didn't do it, and I've got one right now where that happened. They clearly had written direction to the bank to make the distribution. They didn't do it until sometime in January, and so we're in the process of trying to get a waiver of that penalty because of reasonable cause.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Yes, hi. I've got some questions that have to do with the cost of purchasing a second home. This isn't a vacation home. This is a case where we're moving, but we currently own the two homes. And we're renting out the second home until we make the move in the summer to our new jobs. And what we're trying to figure out is, we already know we can't deduct the mortgage under itemized deductions for the second home, correct? Because we're renting it out.
Well, is the rental simply you're simply doing it to cover your costs until you move? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. It is likely that you really, while you might be renting it, you haven't really converted it to a rental property.
No, we haven't.
In which case, it would still be treated as a residence, and you would be entitled to a deduction. Now, generally what would happen is that you would show the rental income and rental expenses on a Schedule E.
Right.
So that you would offset. But if you are limited, mm-hmm, under a set of rules known as the vacation home rules, and I realize this isn't a vacation home.
Right.
The excess interest expense and real estate taxes that you were not in, that you might not be entitled to on Schedule E would be allowed on Schedule A as an itemized deduction.
Okay.
So you would not cheat yourself out of those deductions by renting the house to cover your costs.
All right. The reason I thought we couldn't, I don't remember the exact details, but it had to do with having to live in that house for a certain number of days or something like that. That year, and last year we have not lived in it more than maybe 4 days when we purchased it, and we're just getting it, you know, a few things done in it. But that doesn't restrict us. I thought there was some rule if it's a second home.
Well, there is a rule for vacation homes that talks about 14 days or 10% of the rental period.
That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
Yeah, that's and
but
what
still
that,
be a vacation home.
Yeah, that rule says that if you rent the property out.
Mm-hmm.
But if you and use it more than 14 days or 10% of the rental period, then your deductible losses for the rental activity will be limited to the income that you collect from renting it. In other words, you can't create a great big artificial loss by renting this out. But in the case that you've described, that wouldn't apply and you would be entitled to that deduction.
Okay. So even though we have two different homes, the fact that we're not aiming to have it be a rental makes the difference.
Right.
You're allowed
a deduction on first and second residences.
Okay, let me ask then also about the closing costs and the points. Would we be able to deduct those costs?
Well, as long as it's your principal residence.
Well,
that's
the problem.
And normally, if it's your principal residence and this is the first loan on it, it's not a refinance,
right,
then generally you can deduct those points in full in the year that you pay them.
Right.
Now, in this particular case,
It's going to be your principal residence, isn't it?
And you it certainly is.
Yeah. Then you should be okay. There are other closing costs, though, that are not deductible.
Right, like the legal fees.
Exactly.
Right.
Appraisal, legal fees, inspections, those kinds of things are not deductible.
Okay, not legal fees, inspection, or appraisal. Basically, the points are what would be deductible.
That's right.
Okay, so if there's no cheating involved if we deduct the points, even though we're living in a different home still.
That's right.
Okay.
Now, because this is going to be this will be your principal residence.
Right.
I mean, you just haven't moved into it yet.
Right. We definitely will be moving into it in the summer as our principal home.
Okay. Yeah, I don't see a problem with that.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay. Good news for that caller, huh?
Yeah.
That's nice. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, two tax experts from the Champaign office of the tax accounting and consulting firm of RSM McGladrey, Marty Verdick and John Breen. Marty is a managing director at RSM McGladrey. John Breen is a manager in the firm's tax department. Listeners, your questions about taxes are welcome this afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, speaking about homes, I imagine that a lot of folks have refinanced mortgages recently, given interest rates. Can one deduct points in a refinancing situation?
They're deductible, but they're deductible over the life of the loan. So unlike the previous caller, because it was the initial purchase and the initial financing, they get to deduct those points in full in the current year. If you refinance, those points are deductible, and you amortize those over the life of the loan. So if it's a 15-year loan that you're taking out, you essentially get 1/15 each year as a deduction. So it's going to end up being a very small amount per year.
Okay.
If one point on that, if you subsequently pay that loan off or refinance it again, any unamortized points that you hadn't already written off, you get to deduct in full in that year.
Okay.
And actually, with the talk about points, I don't see that many people, with interest rates where they are today, I don't see that many people paying points. John, have you seen many at all?
No. I mean, most of the time, people are taking zero-point loans.
Right.
It's pretty rare to see that.
People, a number of years ago, when interest rates were in double digits, people would pay points to buy down the effective interest rate, which is how that works. I'm not seeing a lot of activity in points right now.
Yeah, there's every Sunday in the newspaper, they run a kind of a checklist of, you know, what's available in the community as far as mortgage rates go. And I haven't really paid attention lately, but yeah, even just a couple of years ago, it seemed like you might buy down.
Yeah.
Let's talk with another listener on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
My question has to do with underpayment of taxes. Did a rough estimate on taxes for last year, and I underpaid by about $1,200. And it's also what I've paid in so far with my withholding is slightly less than what I owed last year, the year before. And I'm looking for any other way that I can avoid paying a penalty.
Well, essentially, there are two ways to avoid penalty. One of which you've already referred to, and that is that you have to pay in more this year than what your tax was a year ago. So if we fail that exception, then you have to, on a quarterly basis, pay in 90% of what your current year tax liability is. So ultimately, it's going to depend on, with that $1,200 that you owe, where that puts you percentage-wise compared to your total tax.
Slightly less than 90%.
Then it sounds to me like you'll have a penalty.
Okay. I've converted my IRAs over to Roth, and I'm making the 4-year average payments for that.
Right.
Does that in any way exempt me?
I don't believe so. I think that the first year that it did, but I think that in intervening years, what the IRS has basically said is that you know that that's an income that you're going to have in future years, and I don't believe there's an exception for that anymore to get out of the penalty.
Thank you.
Yeah, the penalty, just by the way, is calculated based upon your underpayment. So if you are very, very close to having covered the prior year tax or the 90%, the penalty is only based upon that deficiency. So if you're within a couple of hundred dollars of covering the prior year tax, your penalty is only going to be based upon the $200 deficiency, not on the whole $1,200 that you owe with the return.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, you're
okay,
welcome.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener in Terre Haute on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about IRAs. I put the max into my IRA at the beginning of the year and then ended up not working.
Okay.
Can I just convert that to a spousal?
Well, let me ask a couple of questions. You had no earned income during the year, is that correct?
Not much, a few $100.
Okay, so because you are allowed an IRA contribution equal to your earned income with a maximum of $2,000.
Even though my expenses exceeded my income.
Well, it is net earnings, so are you self-employed?
Yes.
Okay, if your expenses exceeded income, then you had net self-employment income of zero or less.
Right.
And so you wouldn't be eligible for an IRA contribution based upon your own income. Now, you mentioned spousal. Are you married?
Yes.
Okay. And does your husband have earned income?
Yes.
Okay. Had he already funded an IRA?
Yes.
Okay. My recollection here is that, and John, jump in, but as I recall, you would be eligible for a spousal IRA. Even though you didn't have earned income, as long as your spouse had at least $4,000
right.
of earned income, he would have to have $2,000 for himself to fund his to support his IRA contribution, and $2,000 to support your IRA contribution.
Right.
It used to be that the rule was written a different way, so that if you had $100 of earned income, you would have been limited to $100 even in a spousal IRA. But that has changed, and as long as your husband has at least $4,000 of earned income, $2,000 apiece, that IRA contribution could be supported, if you will, by his earned income.
Okay. Do I just call them and ask them to convert it to spousal, or?
I don't think there's even a designation. As I recall, there's no designation you even need to make on that. Just the fact that between you and your spouse you had that $4,000 of earned income, the bank isn't going to care.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next, we go to a listener on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I've got a daughter who went to school in one state, worked in another state, and lives in Illinois.
So okay.
She's got income, a W-2 from Iowa, a W-2 from Minnesota, and I'm not sure whether she worked in Illinois or not, but this is her sort of home. What do I need to do state tax-wise?
Well, if she's got W-2s from the other states, more than likely she's going to need to file a return there. Does she also have withholding from those two states?
Maybe.
Okay, because that would be another thing to look at. I mean, depending on how much she made, she may fall underneath their minimum filing requirement. But if she has withholding, she's probably going to want to file a return in those states anyway, so that she can get that withholding back if that were the scenario. But more than likely, she's going to need to file a return in all three states. She'll need to file in the two other states that she worked in. And if she's an Illinois resident, she needs to file a return there and then claim a credit for the taxes that she's paying to the other two states.
So she has to pay the other state taxes, and then she gets a credit from Illinois for taxes already paid.
Well, she gets a credit. Now, it may not be dollar for dollar, because the way Illinois' credit works is they base it on Illinois' tax rate, which is 3%. So you could have an instance where another state maybe has a state tax rate of 5%. You could still end up not getting, you know, full credit in Illinois for the taxes you've paid to that other state.
Okay.
But she will get credit for some of it.
All right. Well, that's not the answer I wanted. But.
Illinois Schedule CR is the form you're looking for there. And good luck with that. It's not all that difficult, but she will have to file as a non-resident in two of the states and then Illinois as a resident.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. And here's, I suppose, where the Internet can come in really handy. I bet other states' tax forms might be on the Internet.
Yeah, virtually.
So that makes it handier. Yeah. In the old days, you'd have to send away or...
Well, generally, in the old days, you'd go down to the library, and most public libraries, at least in cities Champaign-Urbana size, would have forms available. You could go down and stand there with a handful of nickels at the copy machine and copy the forms and copy the instructions. You're exactly right with the Internet today. Virtually every state that we've looked at has websites that you can download forms and instructions and get all the information you need right off the Internet, which does make it considerably easier.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, this one in Charleston. Hello.
Hello.
How are you today?
Just fine. Just fine.
Okay.
The question I have is about Roth IRAs versus, what are the other ones called?
Traditional IRA.
Right.
Okay.
And are we missing a bit by not buying into those? I am retired now from public school teaching. My husband will retire in December. We have $1,000 a month through withholding or through a tax sheltered.
Okay, the 403B plan or tax shelter annuity
right,
as a teacher.
Right,
right. Uh-huh.
And I just wondered whether we should be taking advantage of either the Roth or the traditional IRAs.
Okay. I'll try and explain this in a way that is fairly easy to understand.
Good.
You are currently covered by a retirement plan.
Right.
Which means that if you make a traditional IRA contribution, you may or may not be allowed a tax deduction for that because of your level of income. Basically, the rules say that if you're covered by a retirement plan and your income exceeds certain levels, you may not be able to claim a tax deduction.
Right.
If you are not, if because of your level of income, you are not eligible for a deductible traditional IRA.
I think we figured out that we are not.
Okay. Then your choices are to fund a non-deductible traditional IRA or a Roth IRA.
Mm-hmm.
Given the choice between those two, if you meet the income limits, and basically your income needs to be under $150,000 on a joint return,
mm-hmm.
if you're under those limits,
right.
the Roth IRA is, in my opinion, far and away the better choice.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for that is that when you withdraw money out of a traditional IRA, non-deductible traditional IRA, the principal that you put in, $2,000 a year, is not taxable, but all of the earnings that you earned on that during the years of deferral
mm-hmm.
would be taxable.
Okay.
With a Roth IRA, you don't get the tax deduction, just as you don't with a non-deductible traditional IRA, but it has the benefit of tax-free accumulation of earnings. When you take that money out of a Roth IRA in the future, that money will come out totally tax-free.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredibly powerful tool, especially for younger people. Now, you mentioned you're nearing retirement, so the advantage of that tax-free growth isn't that significant, but I'll use an example that I ran for someone not long ago, had a 19-year-old son who had earned income. If that 19-year-old simply funded $2,000 a year into a Roth IRA for 10 years
mm-hmm.
and stopped funding and earned, I think I used an 8% interest rate
mm-hmm.
and allowed it to accumulate until age 65, they would have over $1 million in that Roth IRA that would be totally tax-free when it comes out.
Well, that's impressive sounding.
That's the power of compounding and tax-free growth in the Roth IRA. So
mm-hmm.
the bottom line is if you're not eligible for a deductible IRA, I would definitely go with a Roth IRA. If you are eligible for a deductible IRA, then it's a little tougher choice, and the
mm-hmm.
closer you are to retirement age, the less beneficial a Roth IRA is, and you may actually be better off with a deductible IRA.
Even though we wouldn't be eligible for any deduction.
I said if you are eligible for a deductible IRA, then you need to consider that. But if you're not, then I would go with the Roth.
Okay, so definitely we should do a Roth IRA if we have the disposable income,
If you're eligible for it and have mm-hmm. the cash available, even though you might only get a half a dozen years of deferral,
mm-hmm.
that can be important.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay. When does it make sense to convert a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA?
Well, when the rules first came out a few years ago, this is the third year of Roth IRAs now, it was very attractive because the government allowed us to pick up the income that is triggered by that conversion over a four-year period. If we make a conversion today, you recognize all of the income in the conversion in one tax year, and you pay tax on it. There's no clear rule on this, but the younger a person is, the more valuable a Roth IRA rollover would be because they have more years to accumulate earnings tax-free. John, you did quite a few of these calculations mm-hmm. for people, but generally once someone got into their 50s or 60s, it became much less attractive to do a Roth rollover. Is that about where the cutoff was?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. When you ran the numbers on that, it basically, you know, came back to when do you get your return on the fact that now you're paying a bunch of tax sooner than you would. And, you know, people who were in their 30s and 40s, most of the time it made a lot of sense. Anybody older than that, it was real difficult to, you know, to make those numbers work.
And it depends on your interest rate assumptions. And, I mean, if you make the assumption that you're going to make 18% on your money, then the conversion makes a lot of sense. But in today's world, that's not realistic. Mm. So for younger people, by younger, I'd say below 50, it is a fairly easy decision. There is an income limitation, though. Your adjusted gross income cannot exceed $100,000 to be able to do a Roth IRA rollover. If you're eligible, that's something to consider. If you're over 50, it really is an individual calculation, and it depends on assumptions like when do you plan on taking the money out and some things like that.
Okay, very good. Tax questions welcome this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. Marty Verdick and John Breen of the Champaign Tax Accounting and Consulting Firm of RSM McGladrey are with us this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers, listeners. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. That's 333-9455. Anywhere else, you can call us toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL, 800-222-9455. We've got some calls coming in, and we don't have them quite lined up yet, but as we wait to get those callers lined up to talk with us, I have a question from a coworker. This is a state of Illinois tax question. This person purchased a home in 1999, and he is wondering if he can deduct property taxes paid in 2000 on his 2000 return.
Okay, if he purchased it in 99, he would have received a credit for property taxes. Because Illinois pays everything in arrears, so to speak, he would have received a credit for his property taxes for the year 2000 on that closing statement. So what happens is when he gets his bill in year 2000 for his property taxes, those are actually the 1999 taxes that he's paying. So even though he writes a check out for the full amount, the deduction is really the net of what he actually paid with his check and what he was given credit for at closing when he purchased the home.
Okay, very good. Let's talk with some listeners now. We're going to go, I think, to... We've got all those lines lit up now, and I think what we're going to do is go to line one, which is a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I have a specific question, and I think you might want to generalize it for the audience. My wife recently quit her job, and she'll be receiving retirement benefits in the year 2008. And we're short of income until the retirement benefits come in. So it's been suggested that we go into a, I'm not sure, T27T, which will enable us to withdraw money from her IRAs, which are essentially dead since she's not working anymore, and that'll give us income until she gets her retirement. And my specific question is the income that she gets on this 72T taxable? And secondly, you might want to explain what a 72T is for people who have IRAs that are just sitting there and don't think they're eligible to withdraw from it.
Well, there are certain situations. Normally, a person cannot withdraw money from their IRA account until age 59 and a half. However, in certain circumstances, and I believe this is what you're referring to, you are allowed to begin withdrawals at a point in time before reaching age 59 and a half if you agree to essentially annuitize your IRA balance over your life expectancy and to maintain that level of distribution each and every year until you reach age 59 and a half. So, for example, if a person is 55 and you go to the actuarial tables and you have a 35-year life expectancy, you would be allowed to withdraw money from that IRA without penalty if you are annuitizing it over that life expectancy and you agree to do it every year until you reach age 59 and a half. You can't just take money out in a particular year because you need it that year. The second part of the question, would it be taxable? The answer is generally yes, unless you are withdrawing from what was a non-deductible IRA, in which case some portion of it would be a return of your non-deductible contributions and would not be taxable. But the normal taxation and distribution rules would apply, and you generally would have taxable income from that.
Right. Well, if you... basically have, it's really, it's not for your 59 and a half, but it's for 5 years. So if you're 54, or let's say 53, at the end of 58,
you could change it.
All right, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Next we go to a listener in Terre Haute on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
I understand they're bringing back the income averaging. Is that true?
Well, there's currently a variation of income averaging available for farmers, but that is the only form of income averaging that exists, and I'm not aware of any pending legislation or any proposals from the administration in Washington. I haven't seen anything that would return income averaging. John, you're shaking your head. You haven't
no.
seen anything either?
No, just farmers right now.
Okay, thanks.
You're
thanks
welcome.
For the call. Next we go to a listener in Savoy on line two. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I exercised some stock options at the previous company where I worked, and so I'm looking at the 1040 and thinking that I need to file those as a capital gain. First off, is that accurate?
Well, stock options are a very complex area. Were they incentive stock options or non-qualified options?
They were non-qualified.
Okay. When you exercise a non-qualified option, the difference between the fair market value at the date of exercise and the exercise price is supposed to be included in your W-2 form as compensation.
Yes, it was.
All right. Then when you subsequently sell that stock, and I assume that's what you must have done,
mm-hmm.
then your gain reported on Schedule D would be the difference between what you then sold the stock for and the fair market value at date of exercise, because that became your basis since you paid tax on it in the W-2 form. So it's only the incremental change in value between the time that you exercised it and the time that you subsequently sold the stock. And in many cases, a lot of people will exercise and sell the stock immediately, and there would be very little gain or loss, just minor market fluctuations or commission, something like that. But okay. it would go on Schedule D, short-term or long-term, depending upon the holding period.
Okay, so if I exercised them and sold them on the same day, then I just need to calculate that difference, if there is any.
Yes, and it's possible. I've had people exercise and sell on the same day, and because of market changes within that day, they get a little bit more or a little bit less than the value that was used and included on the W-2 form. And also, you've got commissions on the sale that would be included in basis that might actually result in a small capital loss.
Okay. So then I still need to include – this is my final question, sorry. I still need to include that amount in the reported income on the W-2, the compensation.
Absolutely. Yeah,
okay.
It is compensation to you, and it goes on line 7, I believe, of the 1040. And then when you sell it, you'll get a form 1099-B from your broker showing the gross proceeds. That goes on Schedule D, but it probably will result in very little gain or loss.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Next we go to a listener in Champaign on line 3. Hi.
Hello, I have a question for you. My wife and I owe about $1,500 in taxes, and we do owe the penalty. My question is, if we marry and file separately, it looks like we would each owe around $750. Would we then avoid paying the penalty?
No, you really don't, because what you have to do is you have to look at your prior year tax and basically allocate that tax between the two of you for purposes of figuring that penalty.
Okay.
Maybe your question may lead to another option. Now, there is a de minimis rule that if you owe less than, is it $1,000, John? You're exempt from the requirement to make estimated payments. You wouldn't even be subject to the penalty.
Yes, that was my question.
Okay,
I'm not sure in a case of a married filing separately though. If that, you know, because a lot of times when you have married filing separate rules, they're exactly half of what the married filing joint rules are.
Yeah.
And my suspicion would be that, you know, if it's $1,000 for married filing joint, it may only be $500 for married filing separately. Because usually you take the married filing joint rules and divide them by two, and that's what you end up with for married filing separate purposes.
Yeah, okay. That's one. We're just not sure the answer on that. It is possible that if the statute is written that it's simply $1,000 per tax per return, you may have found a way around that, although I would suggest that it may not be worth the effort of filing two separate tax returns because the penalty is not going to be a significant number probably.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We have about 5 minutes remaining here in this portion of the afternoon magazine, so if you've got a quick tax question, give us a call, 333-945-5800, 222-9455. Not long ago, there was an antique fair over at Lincoln Square in Urbana, as there is a couple times a year. And I was walking through there, and it struck me that some of these folks are in that business. They're in a business. Mm-hmm. And other folks are doing that because they love it.
Right.
It's a hobby. And I'm wondering, when is a business, how do you...
When is a business a business?
Right, and yeah. When is it a hobby?
Well, and that's a question the IRS asks regularly, because many people enjoy doing things. I'll use a photographer as an example. They like taking pictures. They like to travel to pretty places to take pictures, and they want to deduct all of the costs of all of these trips / vacations. The IRS has thought of this, and we have something known as the hobby loss rules. And basically what it says is that if you have a business activity that the IRS concludes is really a hobby, you are allowed to deduct your expenses only to the extent that you have income from that business. So if you sell $1,000 worth of pictures, you'd be allowed to claim $1,000 of direct expenses relating to that. You can't deduct $5,000 of expenses and generate a big loss. The hobby loss rules have a presumption that if you show a profit in 3 out of 5 years, it will automatically be considered to be a business. You don't even have to worry about the application of the hobby loss rules. Once you get beyond the 3 year, if you don't show a profit in 3 out of 5, then it's facts and circumstances, and the IRS can look at how you conduct the business.
Okay, let's talk with another listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi, I have a question about the new state of Illinois tuition tax, or the credit for tuition, mm-hmm. I think it's called.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if there are any income limitations on being able to accept or take that credit.
Actually, there's no income limitation. There is a limit on the maximum credit that you can claim, and that's $500.
Right.
But there is no adjusted gross income limitation that says that if you make more than a certain amount that you're not eligible.
Wow. That's about the only deduction like that, isn't it?
That's about the only one I've heard of. I know all of the federal credits have income limitations that just eliminate a lot of people.
Okay. Well, thanks. That's my question.
Okay. Thanks for the call. And I think we'll be able to get one more caller in here on line two in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering, I'm retired. My income is a pension and Social Security, and I just sent in $2,000 for a 2001 Roth IRA. Can I do that? Is that income, the right kind of income? What should I do?
Your sources of income were pension and Social Security?
Yes.
Okay. You would not be eligible for a Roth IRA. Any type of IRA contribution requires earned income of at least the amount of the contribution or $2,000. So if your only sources of income are Social Security, pension, interest, dividends, those are not considered earned income. So if you've already done that, you need to notify the bank or broker that's handling it and have that money refunded to you. You have until April 15th to do that, and they will also pay out the earnings that they got on it, and you may have a little bitty amount of tax to pay on those earnings.
Wow. You know, I think they told me any income.
No, it has to be earned income.
And the IRS knows what's happening because they send a notification of IRAs to IRS.
Yep, they sure do.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, that's where we'll wrap it up this afternoon, but you guys are going to be back next month, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, very good. Marty Verdick and John Breen have been with us this afternoon. They are tax experts from the Champaign office of the tax accounting and consulting firm of RSM McGladrey. Thanks so much, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.